Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. On this edition of Crosstalk, we discuss probably the most important question of our time. Does NATO's continued existence essentially guarantee the outbreak of World War III? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guests, Martin Jay in Marrakesh. He's an award-winning journalist and commentator. And in Budapest, we have George Samueli. He is a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. On this program and on our podcast, we've kind of chronicled the trajectory of NATO in this conflict. And we have this conflict because of NATO, because NATO's expansion at the end of the Cold War, which was unilaterally interpreted as a victory by the West, was the alliance was designed without Russia and against Russia. And that has not changed. And until that calculus changes, we will not have a stable peace in Europe. George.
You summarized it perfectly, Peter. That was the NATO strategy. They seized that moment of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, to essentially marginalize, encircle, and dispatch Russia from Europe once and for all.
So unfinished business.
I mean, it's like going back to the 19th century, going back to the two world wars and everything. It was unfinished business. So, and now NATO's position is nobody tells NATO what to do. NATO will just continue expanding, and it has a right to do so, has an obligation to do so, and it will do it. So the problem that we're having now in Ukraine is that whatever the outcome, NATO will just continue to do what it was doing before. So, you know, whatever Russia achieves as a result of the so-called special military operation, NATO will continue to wage this war against Russia. NATO, whatever rump state that continues to exist in place of Ukraine will be used as a battering ram against Russia into the indefinite future. And therefore, ultimately, we are in a position that this war will just never end. And while NATO is driven by this ideology that we have to go on expanding, and essentially now they're planning Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, right into Central Asia, they want to open a liaison office in Japan. So essentially, NATO is now is built on this dream of limitless expansion and limitless world domination. Well, there cannot be peace and stability under those circumstances.
Yes, well, that summarizes it quite well, Martin. But there could be a naysayer, and that country is Russia, and this is what we have. We have a pushback here. I agree with George's summation. However, if NATO does not capture all of Ukraine, then it is a form of defeat. I mean, is it a deal breaker? Maybe not. But I think that the NATO alliance is taking great, at least some members are, Joe Biden is, for example, is that going too far too fast, you know, make sure that Russia is will always be an enemy. And is that something they want? And we'll talk about the low cost of hegemony here. But I mean, it is it's a very big gamble on their part, because NATO is not going to win in Ukraine in the way that they believe that they should or could win.
The classic sense, militarily speaking, of winning. No, that's never going to happen. And I think it really, the real poignant point here is that who realizes that, and at which point do they realize it? You know, you have these divisions within NATO, within the Western elites. You've got most of the Eastern European countries who are more sensitive to the repercussions of this war going further and want to do something very, very quickly. They want results very quickly, and they're even prepared to go as far as suggesting putting troops on the ground. That's a World War III scenario, no question about it. You have the other group of, say, Dubs, France and Germany, who take a very much pragmatic view of the war and don't really want to go that far. And then you have what I call the nutter in the room, which is Britain. I mean, just a lunatic. You know, the British have always, from the very beginning, just wanted to go full out war, guns are blazing, you know, let's rewrite.
Is it because they face the lowest costs?
No, I think there was some history. First of all, they had a long, many years of supporting the regime since 2014 militarily. And I think that bedazzled Boris Johnson when he came into office. That was his Churchillian moment of actually, you know, going back in history and riding on the back of all that. But then you've got America. And America is now always, and always has been from the very beginning, looking at this project as a way of how can NATO just keep on benefiting us? How can we use NATO as our hegemony tool? You know, this idea that America is the leader of NATO is actually somewhat naive. It's not the leader of NATO. It is NATO. It controls it entirely, lock, stock, and barrel. Just look at the narrative. Look at the speeches. Look at the press releases, everything. And that it defines actually who the NATO boss is. It's always a puppet. It's always somebody who knows how to dance the tune, who will be completely servile to Washington's wishes. You know, but NATO's got a lot of problems because it has a turning point now with a meeting in Vilnius. And I think that will present new challenges for it. You know, we talk about a possibly two-speed NATO, three-speed NATO. I mean, NATO does not do diplomacy. It only does military escalation. And military escalation, by definition, to keep yourself relevant, to keep yourself in the newspapers every day, to keep the spotlight on the organization, you know, by definition, that means the ratchet keeps clicking and the escalation keeps mounting. And it's a shame because when we talk about diplomacy, what can NATO do? It gets itself tighter and tighter into this corner, or it digs itself deeper and deeper into the hole, and it has to face the humiliation of people like Emmanuel Macron going around the world asking people to find a peace deal for the Ukraine. You know, I mean, that must be incredibly humiliating for Stoltenberg, that he's got, you know, EU giants like that begging the Chinese. Now, just this week, the Saudi Arabia Crown Prince was in France, in Paris, meeting Macron. And the big subject was, how can we find a solution to the Ukraine? So, you know, we are reaching out to anybody. We're reaching out to the Arabs. We'll be reaching out to just about anybody who can break this crazy downward spiral that we've got ourselves into. But the future of NATO looks very shaky, in my view. You know,
I do agree, but what's really interesting, we have to kind of, I like thinking counterintuitive on this program, and it's something, an idea that George has expanded on ever since the start of the conflict, is that, you know, this is just a perpetuation of American hegemony on the cheap via NATO. I mean, it's pretty, cost-wise, yeah, it's on the cheap, okay, George?
It is, and that's why the situation is so dangerous, because if the United States were paying a heavy price, and by price, it means human lives, America can just simply write any check at all. I mean, it's all on credit, so it doesn't matter. None of it ever really counts. So as long as that's all it is for the United States, it can go on doing so. But if it's losing American lives, then the pressure would mount for a change in policy. But the problem arises is that NATO is now, and that means with the United States, they are going on in this relentless zombified way, irrespective of any dangers that arise, because they've now convinced themselves that Russia is afraid of us and we can go on doing what we're doing, because Russia will not escalate. And so we have, Stoltenberg declaring that, we will continue doing everything that we're doing. But Putin, when he talks about nuclear weapons, you know, that's just reckless talk. But we see no change in Russia's nuclear posture. But of course, he's lying here, because Russia has changed its nuclear posture. It's now stationing tactical missiles in Belarus. It's walked away from participation in the New START treaty. Putin has said that he's now put his nuclear forces on the higher state of alert. So all of these things Russia has done. And there are basically no nuclear talks going on at any level today, you know, neither strategic level, intermediate level, tactical level. So Stoltenberg just says, oh, well, there's nothing to worry about, except when Putin is engaging in reckless talk. So this is where NATO has got us. But there's to be no change in policy of NATO, even though the world gets ever more dangerous.
Well, Martin, when NATO has the global aspirations, obviously, it's already been pointed out here, they want to start an office in Japan. I thought it was the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. But I mean, the inability to achieve a victory as they define it in Ukraine does send a signal to, like, you know, Moldova and Georgia and other countries, is that it's not this superhero alliance, you know, that it likes to make itself out to be. Remember a couple years ago, you know, criticizing NATO on Twitter was something you get in a lot of trouble for, because we're supposed to venerate, you know, we're supposed to respect NATO, okay, a military alliance of all things. But I mean, that's the challenge too. I mean, we'll finally get Ukraine in the rump state of what? I don't know, the People's Republic of Kiev? That's not a good calling card.
Well, whether it's Moldova or whether it's other countries in the region that are looking at NATO and considering their options over the next few years, you know, nothing looks good. Nothing. I mean, NATO has not learned the lesson that the European Union hasn't learned either. When I was in Brussels in 2004, the European Union expanded. It had another 10 members, and now it's expanded again since then. And the argument was always, the bigger we get, the more credibility we have, the more power we have around the world. But that's not true. That's just not the case. You know, the bigger you are, the more members you have who can oppose your views, the harder it is to get a unified idea agreed on, you know. And all look at the European Union, all the big stuff, all the big international foreign policy stuff, taxation and defense, they can't get any agreement on. You know, so that's why. Yeah,
but Martin, they have kind of, in a way, gotten around that. And again, you know, it's something that George has pointed out to me a number of times, is over in rapid succession, the EU has essentially just surrendered its foreign and defense and security policies to NATO, which of course means it's surrendering it to Washington. And so you don't have to worry about so much about consensus, do you? Because it's already decided in some air-conditioned office in Virginia.
Yeah, but they've given up on it because they realize they can't do it. You know, so it's much more simpler to make it America's problem and we'll follow the Americans. That is, by the way, the default position of all EU institutions that have an international division, an international wing. Follow America. When in doubt, follow America. But what's happening with NATO now is really interesting. I mean, what we really need to put NATO in check is an Eastern defense organization, you know, which can hold it to account. Because at the moment, the journalists aren't really doing anything remotely objective in their reporting, because nobody's actually feeding them with any different ideas that oppose the current narrative. But if you look at on the ground what's happening, there's a lot of panic going on. And this can't bode well for NATO.
On the word panic, let's take a short break, gentlemen. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to return and continue our discussion on NATO. Stay with our team. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the Home Edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Martin in Marrakesh. You made me quite aware of the word panic in the first part of the program. Continue, my friend.
How else do you explain the situation? You know, if the West, under NATO's guidance and material, was making any progress at all on the battlefield, why do you suddenly have a Ukrainian leader who is banging his fist on the table, getting sweatier and sweatier in these YouTube moments and demanding more and more that Ukraine gets fast-tracked into NATO membership? Why do you need to do that? If you're winning, you don't need that. You know, why does that become such a critical point that we have to do this now, we have to get in? Because you're losing. And, you know, one of the conditions of foreign journalists operating in Ukraine is that you have to sign up to an embedded situation with a press card, you have to get escorted everywhere, you have to get permission to visit places. And one of the unwritten rules of journalists operating in Ukraine is that they can't report on numbers, they can't report on casualties. They're not told casualties, so they have to make estimations. It's very difficult to make estimations when you're in one part of the battlefield and something's going on elsewhere. You know, you have a front line of something like 700 kilometers. I'm sure someone will correct me. So the Ukrainians have punched a couple of holes and taken a few villages in the last couple of weeks. You know, big deal. That really doesn't amount to anything. I mean, what the real debate is now is, we have to move away from the battlefield scenario because we're not winning. What are the other options? You know, we keep hearing a lot of talk about F-16s, but there has no credibility to it, and there's no time left. You know, the experts will tell you that training pilots for F-16s realistically, you're looking at 9 months. These reports of 3 months are ridiculous. You can't train any pilot in F-16. And would you want to? Would you want to?
Yeah, but Martin, if we think over the last 30 years, the global war on terror, okay, F-16s, F-15s, well, you know, the Americans weren't worried that the Taliban was going to shoot down their planes. Okay. The same thing happened in Iraq. Okay. Now you send in, and remember, F-15s are from 1979. Okay. I mean, they're not new. Okay. I mean, you know, there's no magic bullet here. I mean, we've seen German tanks, American tanks just melt. Okay. Yeah. Melt. Okay. They melt like any other tank. I mean, yeah. I think people are deluding themselves that there's some kind, you know, if we just send F-16s, the war will be over.
But they're deluding themselves, but the timeline doesn't make any sense. And I think this is contributing to some of the panic we're seeing at NATO. At really best, the most the West can do, if we talk about air assaults, is in 9 to 12 months' time, at best. So what do you do in that period? What do you do that into that intermediate period? You haven't got the soldiers, you haven't got the numbers. You know, you punch these little holes in the front line, but what's not getting reported is a lot of the tactics on the Russian side. American majors and colonels, there's one or two of them who are very, very well informed, who are telling us about this line of mines that the Russians are laying on the other side. So they're drawing the Ukrainian troops in through a corridor. Ukrainian troops may be taking a few villages here and there, but if they come under a fierce attack, they're going to want to scarper. Now you turn around and you find that you can't scarper because in the meantime, the Russians have laid this line from helicopters of these super mines, which you can see, they're not even hidden. You know, so I think this is part of the tactic which the Russians are doing, which it was doing very well. Putin is taking his time and that is his winning strategy. He's not rushing in to take Odessa. He's not rushing in to think about an air assault. He's taking his time because he knows every single day that passes, he wins. He just conducted a press conference for 3.5 hours to journalists, unscripted.
Joe Biden
can't even manage 3.5 minutes without losing his place on stage and then saying, God save the Queen, man. What the hell?
We're kind of back to who's got the clocks and who's got the time. George, this it's already been mentioned the NATO summit in Vilnius is just around the corner here, and there's that word panic that comes up again here because how do you get the Ukraine into NATO? They've made their promise. You know, NATO has to keep its promise here, but it's not so simple, obviously, because if they induct Ukraine into NATO now against its own rules, because there are pathways and well known and very well documented, but then they would be inheriting a war with Russia. And that's something maybe the Poles and the Baltic states are, you know, crazily interested in, but not everybody in the alliance is. Even Washington feels that way. George.
No, that is right. And that could certainly happen, that the Poles do get themselves involved. I mean, there's obviously a lot of talk about the Polish mercenaries already fighting in Ukraine. The F-16s could well be based in Poland. So in other words, that they could be take off and land on Polish air bases, which again could mean that Polish air bases could come under Russian attack. And that again may well be part of the tactic of how to get NATO in under Article 5. but at the moment, as this war goes on for NATO, they're not losing any lives. So they're saying, okay, it's the Russians who are suffering. I mean, Ukrainians obviously are suffering greatly, but NATO doesn't really care about that. So they can keep this war going because there haven't been any great crises within NATO. There hasn't yet been any major economic crisis. Obviously, you know, there hasn't even been a great energy crisis. Could happen, but there hasn't been. So they think that, hey, we are sitting pretty. Our lives are very nice. They are suffering. And they can basically think we can go on like this for 2 or 3 years, and then let's see what happens in Russia. That may be a foolish calculation, but that is how NATO is thinking. So
George, if you're part of the Ukrainian elites, whatever that are, oligarch, military, political, that's not a very good calculation, is it?
No, it's not at all good calculation. But they have allowed themselves to be pushed by NATO. I mean, the other day, Putin revealed this agreement. They had an agreement signed. He showed the documents to the African leaders. Look, Ukraine signed this agreement. It was a good deal. I mean, it's even now amazing that Ukraine turned it down. Why did Ukraine turn it down? Because it was told to turn it down. So there it is. Ukraine has no agency. It has no sovereignty. It does what NATO tells it to do, contrary to its own interest. This was a very good deal. Amazing. I don't think Russia should have given them that deal, but they did get that deal.
Well,
but,
George, you know, I've said that, you know, we don't have to rely upon future historians. We'll be relying upon future psychologists and how a country as leadership would buy into this. Martin, I'm glad that George brought this up, because the essence of the deal that was hammered out in the first weeks of the conflict was Zelensky was essentially being asked, number one, Ukraine must be neutral, certain limitations on its military. But most importantly, and this is why we'll need psychologists, he was asked to give up what he already did not have. And that's what made it such a good deal. Give up on the Donbass, give up on Crimea. He had neither. And that's why it is insane to think about how that deal was turned down. Martin.
And I think that's also contributing towards now the situation that Putin finds himself in. Because now all the great commentary analysts who are writing for the big newspapers now, none of them now are painting scenarios of a peace deal that Putin will make, because he's advanced too far. You know, he's at that point now where all he needs to do is just keep on with this very cool head and not do anything too ambitious and just keep on draining the other side, you know, like a very talented long-distance boxer who really does draw the energy out of your opponent. And so by round 10 or 11, you know, somebody's very weak on their knees. I think that's the strategy that he's doing, and it's winning. You can't deny it. It's winning. Look at the statistics. Look at the figures. You know, look at the amount of Bradley armored vehicles that were destroyed in one day, 16. You know, look at what America is sending. There is a huge difference between what they need on the battlefield and what's available. Going back to the F-16 point, what I didn't finish my point in making is that we can talk about F-16s all day, but the truth is the Europeans don't have them. They don't actually have them. So why are we wasting all this newspaper print on the subject of F-16? You know, the Netherlands, the Dutch have got maybe 40 in total. The Belgians have got 20. The Belgians have got old generation F-16s. And every now and again, they might put one into as a spare that they could give to another country. So there aren't the numbers there for F-16s. You know, people are talking about the Swedish fighter now, but that Sweden's not even, you know, it's not possible to do that in such a short space of time. But I think now, you know, all the focus now is going to be on Biden. Because, you know, he has to justify all this. You know, George said before that the Americans don't really care because they're not losing people on the ground. No, but Biden is going to start losing votes. And, you know, as these months go past, you know, I think Putin knows that. He knows that as more of these scenes that take place of Biden's dementia, you know, transpire on the internet, and he becomes looking more and more foolish, I think there is a real danger of a division within NATO. And the division could be Europe versus America. So
that's assuming that Biden is, this is Biden's policy. It's the people around him. Okay, they have a very failed vessel as their spokesperson. But I don't think that we will see how much that plays a role. I mean, I don't understand why it isn't painted as Biden's war, because that is, and Trump has essentially done that.
Well,
okay.
It is Biden's war, and you've only got to look at the coverage for the last week or so of this of these FBI documents, which have been pointing the finger at Biden's involvement in Ukraine, the $5 million bribes from the energy companies. We've known about this for months.
I know.
It's been on the net. Finally, it gets to the FBI, and what do you find? You know, you find Ted Cruz doing this award-winning performance of someone who believes so passionately in democracy, trying to tear apart this FBI guy who's not going to actually reveal anything about these documents. But there is a conspiracy within the FBI, certainly amongst Democrats, to not get this guy, get this president.
Yeah, well, I'm not convinced that the corruption of the Biden family is going to be a point of inflection when it comes to Ukraine. George, we're rapidly running out of time. I know you want to jump in.
Yeah, I think so. The by and large, there is a consensus among both political parties and among America's elites to keep this war going. Trump is going against the consensus. But as we know with Trump, it's always very difficult to know which way he's going to go. He's saying he's going to end the war in 24 hours. But remember, 2016, he was promising to have good relations with Russia. And then his boast was, hey, I'm sending lethal weapons to Ukraine, which my predecessor, Obama, was too scared to do. So we just don't know which way Trump will go. But I don't see any break within the American foreign policy consensus. But
there won't be a break unless they're forced to break, okay? And it's going to be events on the ground. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Marrakesh and in Budapest, and I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, cross-talk rules.